Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, October 15th. It was a week that began in Europe with Belgium bailing out Bank Dexia for a second time, the other being 2008, for $5.4 billion amid a severe liquidity squeeze. Dexia wasn't even on the radar until about 10 days earlier. It has a mountain of Greek debt, and other banks had stopped lending to it. But on top of the nationalization, the governments of Belgium, France, and Luxembourg, the latter two where Dexia also has a presence, provided an additional $121 billion in funding guarantees, with Belgium kicking in 60.5%, France 36.5%, the remaining 3% from Luxembourg. So depositors were secured as part of a good bank, bad bank breakup. And remember how Greece was to receive the latest 8 billion euro installment from its first bailout by October 13-14. Now it's early November, but don't worry kids, Greece will get it, according to the Troika of the International Monetary Fund, the European Union, and European Central Bank. Greece is nowhere near its deficit target for 2011, which was 7.5% of GDP. Now try 9.1% after just a few weeks ago being upped to 8.6. Then again, Greece's debt ratio is basically the same as ours, 8.6% for fiscal 2011, which just ended September 30. So now we have two key dates. EU finance ministers meet this weekend to set the table on the debt crisis for the annual EU summit, October 23rd, at which point the agreement on solving it is supposed to be finalized in time for the G20 summit on November 3rd and 4th, where it is expected that all the world's major players will sign off, the markets will rally further, and Christmas will come as scheduled, setting up for 2012, that would be a year to remember, when all the world joins hands, buys oodles of consumer goods, continues to pay down its debts, and Iran's nuclear weapons program is dismantled voluntarily, as Ayatollah Khamenei tells his people, we had it wrong, the West is the direction we want to take our nation in. As Ross Perot would say, it's just that simple. Or not. Here's the reality check. Slovakia, after initial rejection that allowed Parliament to toss out the existing government and form a new one, approved the European Financial Stability Fund of 440 billion euro. Now European leaders need to figure out how to use it, and they need to do so by October 23rd, or no later than November 3rd and 4th. And then they have to set about getting a further fund or a leveraging of the existing facility. Regardless, it's still unclear just how the EFSF will be used. Also, remember, with each new EFSF or leveraging of the existing one, all 17 are on the hook for a further amount in guarantees. Slovakia, for example, is now in for 4.4 billion euro, or 9% of its GDP, the highest proportionally of any of the 17 members. Over 13% of GDP if the fund is leveraged. Wolfgang Munchau, Financial Times, quote, when the EFSF was first agreed last May, it was supposed to be the big bazooka, a shock and awe strategy, as one analyst famously called it, but it turned out to be a crisis propagator. The fundamental problem of the EFSF is that everybody guarantees each other in a game of dominoes. Italy's guarantees make up 18% of the system, but this 18% lacks credibility. Italy is hardly in a position to pay its own debt, let alone guarantee someone else's. While France is healthier, its guarantees to Italy also lack credibility, and so do German guarantees for France. If you follow the line to the end, there is no ultimate backstop. If you double or treble the size of the EFSF without changing its underlying structure, all you do is double or treble the lack of credibility. If you really want to increase the size of the EFSF without destroying it, then you're left with two options. You have to back it through an unlimited guarantee by the ECB, the only organ in the Eurozone that is in a position to give such a commitment, or you have to change the EFSF's legal status through the adoption of joint and several liability. This means that member states jointly agree to everybody's debt. The two options ultimately mean the same. The liabilities of the system will be shared jointly by all of the participants. If you want to annoy certain people, you could also call the latter a Eurobond. The fallacy of the national guarantees also applies to a recapitalization of the banking sector. I would strongly favor an across-the-board increase in the core Tier 1 capital ratios for all banks, but if member states end up providing the cash, the overall risk of the system remains the same. That also applies if the ESFF were to recapitalize the banks, since its ultimate liability also rests with member states. That was Wolfgang Munchau of Financial Times. And on, so here's the deal. As I noted above, there is none. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy recognize the big banks need to be recapitalized. But there is a huge difference between the two that needs to be resolved shortly. Merkel wants the banks to attempt to recapitalize themselves first by going into the private market. If that doesn't work, then the state is to help the banks. And if that's not possible, then the EFSF could be accessed. Sarkozy wants the banks to be able to use the EFSF first, thus preserving, in his case, France's sovereign AAA credit rating, because the rating agencies won't see the government with new obligations to the banks. Then you have the banks saying, well, if I can't access the EFSF, not that anyone wants to be first because you're giving away just how dire your situation is and you could have a little old run on your institution, you're forcing me to sell assets to increase my Tier 1 capital ratio. But how is that going to help the economy if we have less to lend? You're only tightening credit further at the worst possible time. But what's this? The July 21st agreement on a 21% haircut for Greek paper is now in the trash can? You mean to tell me it's now going to be a 50% haircut? So that means the banks, the major holders of the crapola, have to raise even more capital. Or, as some were saying on Friday, just let the IMF handle the mess. We want to enjoy the holidays, after all. Bottom line, we should learn a lot more about the details by October 23rd, if not November 3 and 4, but this will in no shape or form mean the crisis is solved. Far from it. Though, at least the major players in this game, including individual investors, could exhale. This week, Martin Anderson, Director General of Sweden's Financial Supervisory Authority, said, "We don't see any positive signs when it comes to the crisis. Things are getting worse, and of course, then you're more concerned about liquidity and solvency." European Central Bank President Jean-Claude Trichet said the debt crisis has reached a, quote, systemic dimension and must be tackled decisively. Or, as former Deputy Treasury Secretary Roger Altman put it, the sovereign debt crisis has metastasized into a bank crisis. And the sad part is it all could have been avoided. One other item on the Eurozone, Spain's major banks, as well as the sovereign debt of the country itself, all faced downgrades by Fitch and or S&P in the two cases. Fitch notes that Spain's banks have about $400 billion in problematic assets on the books, many of which will soon shift into the non-performing loan category. No surprise from your editor. Turning to Washington and Wall Street, despite all of the preceding, equity markets around the world have largely staged a nice rally on the feeling Europe would get its act together. Whatever. I can only shake my head, though I have been saying that if you don't believe the U.S. economy is going to double dip, stocks could rally big, and that they have. The Dow Jones up 12% since October 3rd, and the S&P 500 up 11%. In the past week, however, we've learned some sobering things about the average American and this awful period we've been in. For starters, the National Bureau of Economic Research, which decides when business cycles begin and end, noted long ago the recession began in December 2007 and ended in June 2009. Since then, while it's felt like recession, the economy has been growing. So, knowing that, between June 2009, when the recession ended, and June 2011, inflation-adjusted median household income fell 6.7% to $49,909, according to a study by two former Census Bureau officials. during the recession from December 2007 to June 2009, household income fell 3.2%. That was from Robert Pear of the New York Times. Or a decline of 10% since the start of the recession through June 2011. The Wall Street Journal notes that according to census data, from 2000 to 2010, median income in the U.S. declined 7% after adjusting for inflation. That marks the worst 10-year performance in records going back to 1967. The Journal's survey of 50 economists has the U.S. growing at 1.5% this year and only accelerating to 2.3% next year and 2.7% in 2013. However, these guys and gals are always off one way or another. If you believe their employment forecast, though, it is not good. The jobless rate will be at 8.2% at the end of 2013, just one percentage point lower from today in over 2 years. And then there's the deficit, which for fiscal 2011, ending September 30, just came in at $1.3 trillion, making it the second worst deficit year since 2009. 2011 ended up barely edging out 2010 for the silver medal. Plus, we all know that unless the bipartisan supercommittee looking into deficit reduction comes up with a far bigger plan than the $1.2 to $1.5 trillion they are mandated to cut, the picture is just going to get worse. So, yes, it's no surprise many America are fed up, distressed, and scared. I wish I had something good to say, but I don't. Stock market rallies aside, many feel like the 50-year-old Occupy Wall Street protester I saw on NBC News who said of her plight, quote, "My life savings was invested in real estate and the stock market, and now I have nothing." There's a lot I could add about this statement, seeing as how I issued one warning after another over the years, but it's too late. If you didn't receive trusted advice or failed to take even a modicum of personal responsibility, you're screwed. And yes, there are many on Wall Street who should be in jail, and on this issue I totally agree with the Occupy Wall Street movement. But I have further comment in the Week in Review commentary later. Economist Robert Samuelson, Washington Post, quote, "Here are three generalizations about growing economic inequality. First, the increase has been stunning. From 1945 to the late 1970s, the richest 10% of Americans accounted for about 33% to 35% of total income, including capital gains, mostly stock profits," estimate economist Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty. By 2007, their share, the richest 10%, was 50%, equivalent to the late 1920s. Most of the gain went to the richest 1%, whose share rose from about 10% in 1980 to 24% in 2007. Second, it's a global phenomenon. In a 2008 study, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, found that inequality had increased for 17 out of 22 countries over two decades, though conditions vary dramatically by country. In Sweden and Denmark, the richest 10% have incomes about five times greater than those of the poorest 10%. In the United States, the ratio is 14 to 1. The OECD average is 9 to 1. Mexico has the highest, 27 to 1. Finally, most of America's rich, however defined, don't escape taxation. In 2007, the richest 10% paid 55% of all federal taxes, estimates the Congressional Budget Office. The richest 1% paid the lion's share of that, 28.1% of federal taxes. The average tax rate on the top 1% was 29.5%. Similarly, the richest 3% account for 36% of charitable contributions. Samuelson continues, "There are many theories about why inequality has increased, though no consensus. New technologies reward the highly skilled. Globalization depresses factory wages. Eroded union power does the same. employer-paid health insurance squeezes take-home, employer health-paid insurance squeezes take-home pay. Winner-take-all society confers huge rewards on an elite of celebrities, sports stars, and business leaders, and so on. The backlash against the rich is the start of debate, not the end. Are the rich to be punished for succeeding or merely asked to pay their fair share? Who is wealthy or who's just well off? Is $250,000 a reasonable cutoff for couples, as Obama once indicated, or has that been repudiated? If taxes do rise, what approach would best preserve incentives for hard work, investment, and risk-taking? Well, are Obama's assaults on wealthy business leaders just desserts or political cheap shots? However measured the rich are besieged, the attacks almost certainly will intensify. That was Robert Samuelson. Washington Post. Major market averages extended their winning streak to 3 as the Dow Jones finished up 4.9% to close at 11,644. The S&P 500 rose 6%, its best week since July 2009, while NASDAQ, riding the success of Apple's iPhone 4S launch as well as Google's stellar earnings, soared 7.6%. Both the Dow and NASDAQ are now up 0.6% for the year, while the S&P remains in the red to the tune of 2.6%. Hopefully you don't hear the garbage men in the background, so I'm going to wrap this up. For further details, go to stocksandnews.com. Click on Week in Review. Have a great week. Take care.